Welcome to Inflection Points, helping tech leaders navigate a new path to growth. My name is Joe Hine, and in this episode, we speak with Mark Knorr. You'll love this one because we discuss how after 30 years as a CEO, Mark made the successful transition to your chairman. What happens when a deal goes wrong and you end up in court? And the importance of giving back. And the day that Mark met David Beckham and the King. From SI Partners, this is Inflection Points. Mark Knorr is a serial entrepreneur in the agency space, having sold two agencies and advised on the exit of several others. He was founder and CEO of KitKat Knorr and successfully scaled the business before selling to Publicis. He then joined Fold7 as CEO and grew the business before it sailed to Maroma Group. He's also held CEO positions at national and global levels in agency networks. As an agency leader, his businesses have won over 130 creative awards, 6 Agency of the Year awards, and he personally picked up 3 leadership awards and 3 honorary fellowships of institutes within the marketing industry. He also wrote a column in the FT for 3 years on creative business. These days, he still works in marketing services as well as other sectors too, serving as chairman of 4 organizations, non-executive director of 5 others, and is a qualified executive coach working with CEOs across 3 continents. Mark, welcome to Inflection Points.
Thank you for having me.
So prior to your distinguished career in advertising, you started out in entertainment. What drew you into this world?
Probably accident. I think I got into a school play and my sister said, "You're half decent at that. I'm going to get you into an acting school." It was like an after school club at the time. And it was an amazing place with an amazing teacher. And I waited a year or two and finally got in. Mm-hmm. All of my peers were sort of famous people off the telly. I found myself a bit of a fish out of water.
Yeah.
Absolutely petrified by the prospect. And then, you know, got in the groove and found myself as a young actor on TV and stage.
Interesting. And you ended up on stage with The Temptations. Tell us about this.
That's a completely different story. So a few years acting and at the same time playing lots of music.
Yeah.
In my late teens, took myself off to New York to study a place called the Drummers Collective. Right. I was a drummer. And when I came back, got lots of gigs because I'd been trained in New York and it was a bit cool. And a friend of mine was at a sort of, this is prior to Britain's Got Talent. They were like open mic nights. Okay. In the house band. Couldn't do one particular night. Said to me, "Will you sit in?" By the way, now and again, we get some quite cool people in the house. Yeah. I did that gig. And at one point, the MC said, turned to the band and said, "Give me My Girl by The Temptations." So we struck up My Girl. It's got a very distinctive bass line. I would sing it to you, but my voice is awful. And suddenly, Dennis Edwards' voice emerged from the audience because they'd put the mic on his table. He stood up with all of The Temptations. They came to the front of the stage and they did that number. And it was one of those moments I'll never forget. The drummer, who was called Slowly, because he walked very slowly, fell off his stool. It was magical. It was magical.
Certainly prepare you for the world of unexpected turns.
Something like that.
The advertising industry can sometimes bring.
Something like that.
And so this sort of early foray into arts, how did that lead you into advertising?
Well, I think that if there, and this is all an exercise in post-rationalization, like all career summaries are, but acting, music, university journalism, like student journalism, I would say all these things are storytelling, versions of storytelling and entertainment.
Yeah.
Then post-university, figuring out what was I going to be. I think I was a half-competent journalist. Yeah. Some of my mates were brilliant, already signed up by national newspapers. Yeah. I was just a jobbing freelancer. And someone talked to me about advertising. And it soon dawned on me, because I knew nothing about it other than I'd seen some TV ads like we all had, that when you think about it, every art form is relevant to advertising. Mm-hmm. And it is a form of storytelling, albeit kind of propaganda. And the more I found out about it, the more I realized, wow, I can combine all these things that I've enjoyed. I just needed to figure out which job in advertising I needed to do. And so I tried several until I figured out the bit that I could maybe contribute to.
And which bit do you lean towards?
That's a great question. I don't know. I think I was not particularly gifted at any of them. And so I was promoted out of trouble. and became an MD when I was only 28. But I think my first job, I applied as an account manager or a copywriter.
Right.
And the guy interviewing me, who I still know, said, "So which is it?" And I went, "I don't know, you know the difference." So I think he tried me out in account management. I progressed through that. Then in creative.
Yeah.
The one job I've never done is a strategist. Yeah. Still like to do that.
Yeah.
Quite fancy strategy. And within a few years of that was a young MD.
Yeah.
So I think the orchestration part of it, how you combine all those elements to create this alchemy that is the end product.
Create the magic. So to your first inflection point, the founding of KitKat Noor, what were you doing immediately prior to starting the agency?
Mainly being unemployed. So I'd worked at an agency, got to a stage where I didn't really want to do it anymore, was thinking about what to do next. Mm-hmm. Two mates of mine I had a flat in South London and they had other flats in the building, had started something which at the time no one understood when I said. Mm-hmm. It was a digital music download service.
Okay.
It was in the late 90s when people was like, "Run that by me again, what's that again?"
Yeah.
The notion of listening to a song on your phone, there were a couple of phones that could do that, but not many.
No.
And one of them had the vision, one of these guys had the vision to create a service out of that.
Yeah.
Asked if I would join. I said yes, but I didn't give up my day job. And so we did that together for about a year or two. Floated it on OfX. Mm-hmm. It got a really heady valuation at one point. My guy, who was the CEO, was fated at Downing Street as one of sort of the next Dons, generation yeah. of, yeah, this was during the Blair era. And I still wasn't convinced that that's what I wanted to do. But by the time I blinked, the dot-com bubble had burst and the business had effectively gone bust. Mm. A whole other story, but you know, the music industry was petrified about piracy and just locked down anyone that was in their area and shortened their licenses. And so we got starved of oxygen. So as I was wondering what to do and figuring out actually probably agencies was all I wanted, a former board director at the agency that I was serving at said, "I want to introduce you to a couple of people." And he basically fixed me up on a blind date. That's the short version of this. There's a longer one, but a short version of this. A blind date with Paul KitKat and Vonnie Alexander. Mm-hmm. The guy I'm talking about was called Jeremy Shaw. He's no longer with us, sadly. And the four of us decided to set up an agency, which was called KitKat Noor Alexander Shaw, and often shortened to the first two names, or even just KitKat, because when you've got a partner who sounds like a chocolate, it's rather more memorable than the other names, including mine.
I was going to ask about the names, actually. Why did you choose to name it after the founders? And was that important for the business and the growth at the time?
Advertising agency names itself after founders. Where on earth does that idea come from? So I think it was the way that advertising agencies typically refer to themselves, unless they were highly conceptual names, some of which were ridiculous and long forgotten, some of which were very memorable. You know, Mother, probably the best example of something that was slightly more conceptual.
Yeah.
So we went the more traditional route of advertising agencies and firms of solicitors and accountants and named it after ourselves. And we put the most memorable one first for obvious reasons.
Yeah, yeah.
When no one had heard of us, I remember Paul and I doing a lot of doorstepping, a lot of turning up at brands and trying to get meetings. And receptionists would just say, would giggle and go, "Mr. KitKat," like you made it up. And you're Mr. what? Mars, Mr. Marathon? Well, I was like, well, I'm whatever you want to be. People remembered it.
So it was important to the growth in some ways.
It was important. It was memorable. It was a distinctive asset,
yeah,
as they say in advertising.
Exactly. Would you advise someone to do that today, do you think?
Or call themselves KitKat?
use the names. It's sort of less common, I guess, nowadays.
It is less common. I mean, I think there is a serious point there about distinctive assets.
Yeah.
You know, it's an oversupplied market. So how are you going to stand out? And of course, you know, if you have a distinctive name, that's one way of doing it.
Yeah.
Whether it happens to be your family name, or some people have used their grandfather's name, whatever it might be, or a conceptual name. It's not the only way to stand out, but you know, it's the start of a story.
You need a uniqueness, definitely. And did you know what you wanted to achieve or with when you started the business?
Yeah, we're really clear. I mean, I was the junior partner in terms of age. I mean, only subtly, Vonnie and I are a few months apart, Vonnie Alexander, but the other two were how do I put this politely, a bit older, quite a bit older in one case.
More mature.
Yeah, more mature. And so, you know, we had all been through versions of the cycle, but Jeremy and Paul had really been through it in a major way. They had a really instinctive response of, we don't want to be like other networks, like other agencies. We want to do things our way.
Yeah.
Bonnie and I being that much younger, probably slightly more idealistic.
Yeah.
We just wanted to do it, as it were. Yeah. We were unified around a couple of concepts, one of which was we wanted to create the best agency any of us had ever worked at.
Okay.
It's a very, very simple concept.
Yeah.
But if you want to set up the best company you've ever worked at, that's quite a high bar.
Yeah.
And that very simple principle, I think, manifested across everything that we did. It had to be the best it could be. And on that, we were unified.
And how did you dissect what is best, right? Because there's many angles, there's many stakeholders in the company.
Mm. Like I said, I think it was more a sort of watchword right. than a detailed policy.
Mm.
But you just know it, don't you? So, you know, if you are going to kit out an office, it's got to be gorgeous.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it's not the best. If you're establishing a culture, then that culture has got to be very progressive.
Got it.
You've got to have an environment where the best people want to work and where they thrive. And, you know, Joe, one of the best sort of testaments to this mm-hmm. is that there's a whole generation of people now running very well-known marketing services and advertising agencies who came out of KitKat and all, mm-hmm. who still tell me to this day, because when I give them a reference yep. or they drop me a note, if I've heard it once, I've heard it dozens of times, that was the best environment we ever worked in. There was something about the four of you, the four sure. partners, and the culture that you created that got the best out of us.
Nice.
And there were various things that we yeah. did that made that happen, but that's what we aspired to be, and that was the standard we set.
And the agency grew and was very successful.
Yeah.
What was the best way to grow the agency? How did you kick it on and make it succeed?
I mean, I think that there are different success factors at different stages of growth. In the first year, it's just about survival. Yeah. If I recall correctly, we got investment from a bunch of people who called themselves Mentor, actually. Yep. They were mentors in name and in service of what they did. I think we had about a year's money, and it was approximately month eight before we got our first pitch and won it. We started with a few clients,
sure.
But you know, getting pitches was very difficult. Yep. That's where having a column in a newspaper was quite useful. It was one of many, you know, things that got us leads. And then something amazing happened, which was we won our first 15 or 16, I can't remember which, but we'll split the difference. We won our first 15 and a half pitches without losing.
Wow.
Something special was going on. And we didn't really understand, but why question it? Because you're winning, right. So just carry on.
Yeah.
It was like 18 months until we lost a pitch. And it was devastating for us because we thought this is a team that will win everything. And when we lost our first pitch, yeah. we had to sit back and go, what have we done wrong?
Wow.
It was a really important learning moment. So clearly there was something special there.
Yeah.
Our investors said, and other people said this as well, by the way, I just didn't really understand it at the time, that part of what made the place special was the difference between the four partners. Okay. Someone had said to me prior to setting up an agency, his name was John Vocal, and he had a very, very successful agency in the 90s and noughties called Craig Jones, Watson, yeah. Mitchell, Vocal. And he said to me, an awards due once, he said, you should set up an agency one day. And we were obviously talking about something.
Sure.
And he was doing the kind of young man, I think one day you should. Do you want some advice? I was like, totally.
Mm.
Make sure that your partners are as different to you as you can find.
Mm.
So I didn't set out to do that. But guess what? I had partners that were very different to me
yeah.
and I was different to them. And that in that difference, something special happened.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that's possibly a universal principle. So at that stage of our evolution, those are the factors that worked for us.
Yeah.
And then obviously as you grow and you have to and you have to scale and you have to look at your service diversification, other challenges come in.
Yeah.
But the strength of the partnership team was probably a major contributory factor. I think by year four we were Agency of the Year. That was the first of a series of Agency of the Year things.
Quite remarkable. So I want to sort of move on to your second inflection point in May. So like many, eventually you sold the agency.
Mm.
So where was the business at the time and why did you countenance the sale?
I think there were a few factors. One I recall is at least one of my more senior partners had this notion that we would build this great thing and perhaps after 10 years sell it. It was just a phrase.
Sure.
It wasn't a strategic plan. But guess what? About year 8, 9,
mm-hmm.
we started having approaches. We approached a couple of M&A consultancies. One of them, I think, is familiar to you, Joe. And we set about marketing the business.
Sure.
The big crash happened around 08, 09.
Yeah.
That put a pause on things for a while. But a dialogue we had started then sort of revived. the interest was still there from publicists, as it happened, who wanted to see whether they could give extra va-va-voom to Digitas, a global brand that they owned that wasn't doing so well in this country and in Europe. We were an integrated agency, multidisciplinary, multi-channel, but I think we would all admit at the time that we could be even stronger in digital.
Yeah.
And so a major digital player wanted to buy us.
Yeah.
It wasn't the first expression of interest we had from one.
Sure.
So we were sort of familiar with the notion, and here was one that was showing up saying, will you do this? We'll reverse you in. You guys will run it.
Yeah.
And obviously it also, you know, involved a payday. That,
of course.
That's always helpful.
Yes.
But in terms of the evolution of the business, by then we were up to, I don't know, maybe 150 people.
Yeah.
They were a couple of hundred. Suddenly we were operating at scale, and KitKat nor Digitas was the name of the agency that emerged from that. And I was invited to be CEO.
And the name was important?
I mean, from an ego point of view, yeah, very much so. I think also they were trying to signal that there was something new happening at Digitas. That if Digitas perhaps had some better years in the past and it had a new story to tell, then, I mean, you know, it's a familiar trope, right? We've seen it before with other agencies. Yeah. Buy something that's seen as hot, fuse it together with an established brand, and hopefully you get another chapter out of it.
So can you just explain a bit how the deal was to work then? So you were, as you said, sort of reversing in to manage what would have been quite a large business.
It was a large business, and they had international clients and they had national clients.
Yeah.
And so our job was to preserve those clients and ideally grow them. Our job was to preserve our clients and grow those. Sure. Of course, they were then all of our clients. Yeah. And to make sure that we enjoyed the synergies and benefits of being in a network, because we wanted some of their firepower. Yeah. Access to global pitches, that kind of stuff, which were much more difficult for us as a UK, a small UK entity. Yeah. So due diligence on both sides, the P&Ls combined, suddenly it's one P&L and it's our responsibility to manage the whole lot and grow it. And effectively then becomes one company. Yeah. Within a few months, people forget who came from which side. At first, it's desperately important, a bit of us and them. And our job was to try and ensure that we got everyone to get through this together.
Yeah.
Just a tiny little anecdote for you, because I remember it years later. Paul and I had to go over to Charlotte Street, which is where Digitas were, and give a little speech. We were kind of the new, you know, chief creative officer and chief executive. And he said to me, in the way that he does, you know, I suspect you're going to want to say a few words to the staff. And I said, yes. He said, I just want to say one thing. Is that okay? And can I go first? I was like, yeah, sure. And we're in a cab or something. So he stood up. He's very tall, by the way. You've met him, I think. And he explained to everyone that he understood they'd had, you know, some tough times.
Yeah.
And now this was the beginning of a new chapter. And he asked everyone if they knew how to ski through trees. So he had this sort of sea of nonplussed faces, like, who is this bloke who's very tall and a bit posh? And why is he asking us about skiing through trees? And so he said, so this is how you ski through trees. You look at the gaps between the trees, not at the trees themselves, which obviously was a metaphor for looking at the opportunity, not the obstacle.
Sure.
And that was what we had to do. There were a bunch of difficulties and challenges, but we had to kind of look beyond them, look at the gaps, look at the spaces.
Yeah.
And obviously, whatever it is, 15 years later, I remember that metaphor.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's what we set out to do.
But by no means a simple deal to kind of put together to combine and take on something that is, you know, not much bigger than you, but is bigger than you. Mm. And there's a lot of complexities to unwind there. And inevitably, in any majority of deals, if not all the deals in sort of the agency world, and there's an earnout.
Yeah.
And the earnouts often get bad press. 99% of the deals that we do, there's significant further value that is created as a result of them. However, you were in part in the 1%, and you actually ended up in court.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell us about that?
So there was an initial consideration, and there was an earnout after three years. And when it came to earnout time, we submitted our numbers, and we had calculated what that earnout would be worth, only to find that that the other side contested it and said, actually, because of the loss of a couple of clients, that we hadn't hit the numbers.
Mm.
But those clients were on their side. These were inherited businesses.
Mm.
And what we discovered, because lots of people came and told us, is that they knew that they were going to lose them. So suddenly a big question comes up when both sides have signed warranties. Mm-hmm. And you know how serious that is. We had to provide a list of our clients and their revenues and go, we know of no reason why these clients would review. Let's say the other side had to do the same. And we were told they knew they were going to lose them. So we reasonably went to Paris and said, here's our case. We understand. And we didn't point fingers at first.
Sure.
We understand there's some there were always some question marks around these clients. And maybe some this can be taken into consideration and maybe there's a middle way and a middle ground. We were reasonable people and nobody wants to get litigious.
Sure.
But suffice to say, we couldn't see eye to eye on that. Mm. And what we thought was a reasonable case, the other side didn't. Mm. And so we took the extraordinary step of Jeremy and I by then had left and started litigation. Jeremy was an incredibly smart man, very experienced, and litigation was not something we took seriously. And everyone took lightly, rather. But we took it very seriously. And lots of people said, don't worry, these things never get to court.
Yeah.
So we appointed solicitors and ultimately a barrister. We even got insurance, which is something I just stumbled across. Didn't realize you could insure a court case.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was a lot of money at stake by this stage. Mm. And again, everyone said, don't worry, it doesn't get to court. Don't worry. People, they don't want the full glare of publicity at some point. Well, that some point didn't happen. There was never that call going, you know what, here's an offer.
Yeah.
Very sadly, Jeremy died very quickly of cancer. And before he died, he had said to me, you won't let the buggers win, will you? Right? That's how he spoke. I went, no, we'll fight this. We'll fight this for sure. And all of us wanted to fight.
Of course.
I just never realized that I'd be doing it without him.
Yeah.
And then even up until the trial in the High Court, people were going, don't worry, you won't sit in the stand. They will settle. And there I was in the stand, having been told, by the way, they're going to try and, you know, this is not a reflection of the other side. Yeah. It's just the what happens.
Yes.
But I was advised that they will try and tear you apart. They will try and, you know,
of course,
diminish your character or besmirch your character, make it clear to the judge that perhaps you're not the guy that you think you are or that you present yourself as. It was a deeply unpleasant and very challenging experience. And it lasted 2 weeks. And, you know, I didn't sleep much for those 2 weeks. And fortunately, we won.
Yeah.
But that was a long process. It took many years to get to court, by which time I was already in my next job. Had to say to my new partner, really sorry, I've got to take a couple of weeks off. Small matter of the High Court, by the way, it will be in the press. And, you know, he was really understanding, actually. Yeah. He was very sympathetic. It's not an eventuality anybody wants.
Just a horrible, horrible experience. You embark on a journey of what you thought was partnership and, you know, kind of not both partners are embracing it in the with the same approach. And, you know, it must have been a very tough time for you to...
Incredibly tough. I mean, you learn, I know it's a cliche, you do learn a lot about yourself in these circumstances.
What did you learn?
I learned a lot about how much pressure I could take. Okay. I learned a lot about performance. You know, I was in the dock for 2 days under sustained questioning from a very, very highly skilled QC.
How long would a day be in?
Well, I don't know, like, you know, whatever, a sort of 9 to 5.
Wow.
Well, that's a long time that's being long questioned, time. Right?
Yeah.
And that it is standard technique. I'm not pointing fingers at anyone. He, because he was a he in this instance, is trying to trip you up. He is trying to get you to contradict yourself. Wow. The case files were, you know, sort of many feet behind me.
Yeah.
As in many feet of case files behind me. At any point, he could ask for any one of them to be taken off the shelf and put in front of me and asked me, you know, to account for myself.
Yeah.
Some of these were emails I didn't send, I'd never read before.
Yeah.
What do you make of that? Some of them were texts. We had to submit all our texts and all of our emails, everything. So who knew what he was going to throw at me next? So, you know, that was just very challenging anyway. It would have been challenging for anyone. So you learn a lot about yourself and your resilience and how to deal with stress. You learn, obviously, you learn a lot about business.
Yes.
A mate of mine who's a media lawyer said to me when this was done, he said, Mark, you know, once you've had a week off, got a favor to ask you. We work on deals like this all the time, but we very rarely see them taken to the High Court. Wow. You wouldn't pop into our offices and have a chat with all the lawyers and tell them what it's like to actually go through it. Because he wasn't our lawyer, by the way.
Yeah, of course.
He was just a mate and who had been actually really helpful to me and given me some advice. He just said, none of us have actually seen it go all the way.
Yeah.
So can you come and tell us what it's actually like?
Yeah.
And there were some real insights there.
Yeah,
right? I mean, stuff I won't bore you with now, but, you know, how did that come about? Really, were there a breach of warranties? You know, how could we prove that? What were the one or two bits of evidence that were submitted in court by my genius QC, who was able to stand up and say to the other side, oh, your suggestion is, or your argument is ABC. Yes, it was. Okay. If you open this file,
yeah,
what does it say? And then had them read out things that were palpably untrue.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how ultimately he and his very clever team got the outcome.
Which is great news. You spend so much of your time, have spent your entire career to that point, really, like you say, just trying to make people's brands better, stronger, sell more, more creative advertising, entertaining advertising, and you find yourself in a very different scenario.
You do. It toughens you up, Joe.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it. You know, it's not necessarily the kind of toughening up particularly invited or wanted, but you know, you learn a bunch of stuff about yourself, about other people, about life, about promises, about commitments, about paperwork, etc.
But you moved on.
Mm-hmm.
How long was it before you stepped back into the agency world? You said you were already with the...
So I had a year of non-competes.
Yeah.
I went off to business school for a few months. I went and worked brandside for a few months. And then a headhunter phoned me actually with two jobs simultaneously. And one was a European network job, the obvious next step.
Sure.
And the other one was running a creative agency.
Yeah.
And Kick Handle was an integrated agency or direct marketing agency. It wasn't a traditional advertising agency. So I quite fancied a crack at that as well. You know, I'd run three different categories already. Yeah. Let's see if I could turn my hand to a pure creative agency.
Yeah.
Had never heard of Fold 7.
Yeah.
I'd seen its Carlsberg work. It was famous.
Yeah.
Met its partner and founding partner. And we got on really well.
Yeah.
Very soon I found myself dreaming about it, which is always a good test of what you really want.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was obviously playing on my unconscious and thought, let's do this. So I joined him as a fully fledged partner. And we went to grow his agency in the way that he wanted to.
Yeah. And in what way is it different in the to run a creative agency to the integrated agency?
I mean, it's a great question. And I asked a couple of people in our industry who are rather well known, who had come from below the line marketing and who were now CEOs in advertising, you know, tell me a bit about this and do you think I can do it? And they both laughed at me and went, well, of course you can do it. And anyway, it's much... Direct marketing, you know, digital marketing, much more complicated than advertising. So, you know, in many ways, the principles are the same.
Yeah.
You know, you want to have as clear and compelling a proposition as you can. You want to answer client briefs with a sense of insight and originality.
Yeah. Yeah.
You want to put together teams who are compelling that clients want to work with.
Yeah.
You've got to have a better answer than the next agency. Yeah. That stuff is sort of universal, right?
Yeah, yeah.
As is building team capabilities, building culture. Building a scalable operation. Yeah. These were many of the things that Fold 7's founder asked me when he was looking for his CEO. And he was fascinated by the evolution of Kick Handle and how we did it.
Yeah.
So in a sense, I was going there to do what I'd already done before, but in a different environment, different people.
Yeah. And as you said, you grew the business and eventually Fold 7 sold.
Mm-hmm.
You sold to Maroma.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this was quite an intriguing deal as your role changed almost immediately. Post-deal. Can you talk us through the logic of the deal and what Maroma was trying to achieve?
Yeah, of course. So, you know, Fold 7 wanted a bigger train set, you know, a bigger opportunity, an opportunity to scale, opportunity to, you know, be active in the States and stuff like that. Maroma, I think, already had, Miramar already had, I don't know, 12, 13 agencies. So they were on the path. I think they're at 21 now. They're on the path to growth at the time. And they didn't have a brand advertising agency. And so that fitted in their portfolio. And then there was a surprise, an unexpected aspect of the deal in which they asked me if I would become group CEO of their agencies. They have other divisions as well. They're active in other areas. So I hadn't run a global network before that was highly ambitious and growth oriented.
Yeah.
So it was a chance to learn. So 5 years of being CEO of Fold 7, now, you know, in the hot seat. Or one of the hot seats at Miramar, and a chance to span a variety of disciplines and work with a bunch of new people.
Very interesting. So, having trodden the road of a sale more than once, what advice would you give agency founders that are, you know, planning to sell or thinking about it?
I mean, books have been written about this, as you know.
Of course.
You know, and having done two of my own, and I think advised on three others. Some of which were even bigger than the ones that I'd done myself. There are sort of certain universals.
Mm-hmm.
And also it's clear that every deal is slightly different. So I think you need to be really clear about why you're selling, what you hope to get out of it. I think you've got to take the due diligence really seriously. And I'm not just saying that for legal reasons, but you're joining a new family. You've got to be really sure that that's a culture that's going to suit you and that your growth objectives will be fulfilled, because it's not just about the payday. And then many people think that the culmination of all of this is when you sell. And the reality is that's just the beginning.
Yes.
Because you then got to do it, right? Yeah. I don't just mean an earnout, but I mean, you know, a whole new chapter begins. Your energy levels have got to be fairly high. You know, give yourself a weekend off and come back to work, you know, full of gusto and energy to build the next chapter. Yeah. And then, of course, the shape of every deal is different. So whether it's a fully merged entity like the KitKat Nor Digitas deal was, or semi-autonomy like the Fold7 deal was, the shape of each of those is different. Yes. You've got to be really clear about what's expected of you as a leader, as a well-known coach said at once at one point. I think he named his book after it, What Got You Here Won't Get You There. It's going to require a gear change. Many people aren't ready for that gear change. And I think that's a bigger point from my point of view, having now gone through several of these, which is that so much effort goes into the construction of the deal and not enough effort goes into the post-deal integration and the post-deal strategy and the growth of leaders. Yeah. And forgive me for the really cheesy segue, that's one of the reasons why I do what I do now, which is help leaders lead because they need the support.
Fantastic segue. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Into sort of what's been your, you know, the fourth phase, the fourth inflection point I want to talk about. And you've transitioned to a portfolio career now. Mm. I think I said before, four chairmanships from advertising to a fitness company, five non-exec roles in TV production through to the IPA, your executive coach in the US, the Europe and APAC. Thinking back to the first step away from running a company, how did you adapt from a CEO mindset to a chairman mindset?
Well, I think first and foremost, I've had some great chairmen.
Right.
Unfortunately, they've all been chairmen. Haven't had a chairwoman yet.
Sure.
So I had some great examples to follow. I think I also got to a stage in my life, Joe, where I didn't want to be the CEO anymore.
Yeah.
But I think CEOs are great and they need all the support they can get. And having gone through a formal training in coaching, one of the things I wanted to do was help leaders lead.
Yeah.
So the adjustment to chair isn't so difficult.
Right.
It takes a little bit of getting used to, but you're no longer running the shop on a day-to-day basis. You're no longer, yours is no longer the sort of primary responsibility. It's much more about enabling, making happen, in some instances, keeping shareholders happy, in other instances, orchestrating the various people around the board table, and critically supporting the CEO. So that's the one commonality across all the organizations that I'm involved with. Some, as you know, are fast growth businesses, one's a charity, which is, you know, making sure that there's coherence and support and solid strategy at board level and supporting the CEO.
Yeah.
And I've been one, so it sort of helps.
Yeah. I've seen both sides of the coin. Mm. And what's important to you when you chair a business?
Creating the right environment in which that organization can thrive.
Right.
You know, it's you know, I'm in service to those companies and my name's not above the door anymore. Yeah. I'm not the main man or woman. You know, I'm not the CEO. I need to try to create the right environment in which that company can thrive, which might mean making sure that there's good relationships with shareholders. It might mean helping with fundraising.
Yeah.
It might mean helping the CEO manage his or her team or just being a thought partner to that CEO so that they can be the best leader that they can be.
Do you miss building a business now you're in advisory, or are you happy to leave that behind?
It is a relief not having lots and lots of line reports, frankly, and not having the phone ring at sort of 8 o'clock at night from another country that's just woken up just as you're finishing the day. I don't miss that kind of pressure. I had 30 years of it.
Yeah.
But I have constructed my portfolio in such a way as I am also still in the game, as it were.
Yes.
So I'm an investor in at least half the businesses that you've referred to. I've even set up one or two of my own. And so, you know, I'm trying to get that right mix between kind of being in the game and advising on it.
And one question, because you have, you know, as I said, lots of different sorts of roles with boards. How do you differ when you're a chair to a non-exec within an organization?
It's a really good question. At some level, there's a commonality between the two.
Yeah.
You know, you're brought in as sort of a semi-independent voice to offer, you know, reason and balance and judgment and skill. But as a chair, you effectively are kind of, I guess, the first amongst equals of all those non-executive directors, and it's your job to orchestrate them all and make sure that that orchestra, you know, work well together. Whereas an NED, you just come along and you make the contribution that you can. Yeah. So as a chair, you're planning the agenda, you're supporting the CEO, you're making sure that you're getting through it. As an NED, you're hoping to just come along and add value. Yeah. And then that third string, being an executive coach, different again.
Yeah.
Because then you've got no skin in the game.
Yeah.
You're not around the board table. You're solely there to help the CEO be the best CEO they can be. And that's a wonderfully liberating context in which to operate.
Yeah. I think it's a fascinating step, and different people do it in different ways and different levels of success. And I think it's very interesting how you make that transition into to successfully being, you know, part of the board rather than, you know, the kind of the CEO of the business. I'd like to just change tack again slightly. Yeah. And, you know, I know a big part of your life, and it's been really important to you, has been philanthropy and working with charities.
Mm.
How did you start on that path?
I think I've always had it in the mix. I had a mother who was a Holocaust survivor, who from a very, very young age, taught me the importance of, you know, giving back, of making a contribution. That was her way of reconciling herself to the horrors that she had lived through, is to try and make a difference in the world. So as a young child, I remember going on loads of anti-apartheid marches. Yeah. I remember loads of people in our house who were refugees or people she was supporting. It was just sort of part of the bread and butter of what I did.
Okay.
In the 90s, my entree into advertising was at a social media specialist, sorry, at the time, social marketing specialist, charities, non-governmental. Yeah. And even at KitKat Noor, we had one or two sort of high-profile charity clients. Yeah. So when in 2010, a friend of mine who herself was a chairman and chief exec in advertising, Debbie Klein, said to me, you know, what charities boards are you serving on? I said, none at the moment. I've advised tons of them.
Yeah.
She went, good, because you're about to. And, you know, got me my first gig at a charity. I became chairman of that charity, I think 7 years ago.
Yeah.
And at the same time have become, I guess, an informal mentor advisor to three or four CEOs in the charity space.
Okay, interesting.
As someone that they can come and talk to about innovation, about challenges, about difficulties. And it's a massive, massive privilege. I should have added that I started that whilst I was at Fold 7. I'd had a chat with the founder and said, I want to drop to 4 days a week.
Yeah.
And I want to give my fifth day to charity. So that's been, you know, a good 5 or 6 years of doing that now. So philanthropy, mentoring.
Yeah.
You know, I think if you're in a position to give, whether it's time or money, you should.
Yeah. I kind of agree with that. You're currently chairman of JW3, it's a Jewish cultural center.
Mm-hmm.
As part of your role, you've been rubbing shoulders with King Charles and David Beckham recently. Mm-hmm. And apart from the obvious, what do you enjoy about being part of JW3?
Well, I've got to say, I loved meeting David Beckham, and I'm a Man United fan, so that was a big moment for me.
That is a big moment.
And he was an absolute, absolute gent.
Yeah.
Because the person that introduced us said, by the way, Mark is a Man U fan, and so are his sons.
Right.
And he said, where are they? I'm like, well, they weren't with me at the time. He said, well, have you got your phone on you? And he, I lent him my phone, and he took a video, and he said, what are their names? And he did a video to them, called out their three names and said, your dad's come to see me, and for some reason hasn't invited you. And then gave him a little pep talk about their lives. I sent this to them on WhatsApp. I went, boys, this is from you, from David Beckham. And my eldest son saw it first. He was like, is this for real? Like, yeah. Anyway, so that was nice. It's a huge privilege chairing a cultural centre. It does such amazing work in London, not just in the Jewish community, but across communities. Yeah. It's one of the biggest food banks in North London for all communities. It does lots with, you know, intercommunal relations. So all the fantastic work that it does, it's an absolute privilege to make a contribution to making that happen. Mm. And, you know, it gets a lot of traffic. So, yeah, we have had, you know, the King, and we have had various politicians, and we have had some amazing heads of businesses and performers and entertainers come and make their contribution. Because, you know, it's good to give, and those people feel the same way.
Yeah.
Slightly surreal showing King Charles around the building, I think a month after he had been inaugurated. There you have it. And that had to be a surprise to everyone there. So we just said, there's a VIP coming. Can you all be kind of at your stations, as it were?
Yeah.
And to see the light on their faces, particularly the older people.
Yeah.
We had a lunch and dance, rather, for elderly Holocaust survivors, and to see their faces light up when the king walked in the room. He even joined in their dancing.
That's amazing.
And that made the front page of every newspaper.
I bet it did. One last question. How do you find it differs your roles in business that you're doing to the roles in within the charity sector? I mean, there must be a lot of similarities, but do you have to have a slightly different mindset again for that?
So I would say that the similarities are more important than the differences. Because leadership is leadership. Whether it's setting strategy or clarity of intent or how it is that you harness the collective intelligence of the people around you, sharing the organizations are more similar than they are different. However, there are specificities to the way that charities operate, their governance, the fact that they're not-for-profit entities has both legal and operational implications, the fact that their beneficiaries have a voice too. And that just takes a bit of time getting used to. If you've never done it before, then I would encourage people to say, get involved in the charity, understand its ways. It'll take you a little while, but once you get there, you know, it's worth it.
Yeah, absolutely. And one final question before you go. After looking back, I like to ask my guests to look forward and just say, what's exciting you about the next 12 months?
There are so many things in this world that excite me. They really are. I mean, the thing that gets me going is new possibilities, always has. And unlocking new possibilities for leaders is sort of my mantra. Right. So, you know, we could talk about everything from kind of, I guess, technological change and the possibilities of AI to, you know, new frontiers within our industry. But I think the thing that excites me the most, and this probably won't surprise you given everything else I've said, is the opportunity for better leadership. And I think this year we'll have some elections around the world and hopefully some better leaders will emerge from that. I think that the world needs better leaders. I think business needs better leaders. And making a small contribution to that effort gets me out of bed every day.
Fantastic. Mark, thank you. So great to hear your story.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Inflection Points is a production of SI Partners, the M&A advisor and growth consultancy to creative and technology businesses. Subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Joe Hine, and you've been listening to Inflection Points.